Vibe tribes. Welcome back, people, to another episode of Vibes and Tribes with me, your host, Baze. Today we're gonna have a deep conversation, people. It's a conversation I've been looking forward to for a long, long time. So with that, I will hand over to Catherine to quickly introduce yourself, your role, and then we'll get into it. So yeah.
Catherine, I'm a social worker. At the moment, I'm working as a practice manager. I've worked as a senior social worker for the last few years in like child protection, child in need. So yeah, child and family work.
And what borough are you currently working in?
Am I allowed to say that? So now.
Oh, sorry. No. Okay. Sorry.
I mean, normally they're like some FTSE whatever. I'm in a North London borough.
GDPR.
God. I used to work in East London borough, but okay. Now I'm North London.
Okay. Lovely. And with that, before we dive into it, guys, make sure to like, subscribe, share, comment, interact, just show love, because, you know, 2023, we're really trying to blow out here. So with that, as we like to do on this podcast, let's take it way back. But before we take it way back, Catherine, you know this used to be a travel podcast. As a little bit of an icebreaker, something I like to ask the guests sometimes, you know, you go on holiday, I know you're going on holiday soon, what's the first thing you pack?
I think it's boring, but a bikini. I feel like always in my hand luggage in case, because then I'm like, even if I lose everything else, I can still chill on day one.
Wow,
so that's
bikini.
My priorities.
Okay, yeah, priorities. There we go. And with that, yeah, let's go way back. So we'll start with secondary education. Where did you go and what type of school was it?
So I went to normal state school. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Cambridge, so school was in Cambridge. It was just like the local school to me. Mm-hmm. It was a fairly like nice school. So it was like a state school, but the catchment area generally was quite nice. So I think it was a fair number of middle class families. And I think as schools go, like now, I didn't really know at the time, but as schools go, the like grades and things were really high. So like almost all students would leave with 5+ like A to C GCSEs, which isn't actually like a national average. So I don't think I understood at the time how lucky I was, because it was a really good state school.
And like, what was your personal experience like at the school?
I loved school. I really enjoyed it. I think I was like, I still am, like, I like learning, I like studying, so I was probably like relatively happy to try hard and enjoyed learning and always found it quite easy. So I think I was lucky in that sense as well. Like, I think I am quite naturally academic, so it wasn't stressful for me, where I think for some people it can be more difficult. And it was a small school, like only what, 4 forms in the year, and everyone kind of got on quite well. So it was just, yeah, we had a nice year group, I think. So I think I was just lucky.
And from a social aspect as well?
Yeah, definitely. Like everyone in the year, not everyone probably, but like most people in the year got on, and I think it was generally quite sociable, quite friendly. Some of my school friends are still my best friends today. So it's like, that was a really important time for me. Like I made really deep friendships then, and they're people who are still really important to me now.
Okay, that's great. And in terms of what you ended up doing at GCSE, I know it's a while ago. Do you remember what you did?
Do I remember the subjects? You know what? I don't remember the subjects, but I remember, don't remember all the subjects, but I remember what I got, if you want to know that.
Yeah. I mean, if you're happy to share.
3 A stars, 6 A's, 2 B's.
So whatever you did it well.
Whatever I did it all right, yeah.
Okay, fair. That's really good. And then moving into sixth form, did you go to sixth form? Did you go to college? Did you just continue from your school?
Yeah, so school didn't have a sixth form. So I went to like one of the sixth forms, just like one of the normal sixth forms that was like fed into from all the secondaries. Mm-hmm. I would say I didn't love college as much as I loved school. I think like in college I made a few new friends, but generally my school friends were probably still my main more important people. And I think I worked a lot. So from like 14, 15, I had lots of jobs. So I had Saturday jobs, I had pub job, I had working with kids in an after school club, I was babysitting. So I think I was just quite busy then and quite focused on making money as well as college. Mm-hmm. But I think, I mean, it's gone years ago, but I used to get EMA, which meant that I got money for attending college. So that was good for me, because I think otherwise my attendance could have been worse, because I was working so much. But if you didn't attend, then you would lose your payment for the week. So I think that was quite like,
did you ever lose your payment for not attending?
No.
Enough,
my attendance was obviously good.
Okay. I'm just making sure.
But no, I didn't. Because it motivated you, but it did. I think if you were a young person who had jobs and worked, it was easy to miss if there wasn't something motivating you to keep going, basically.
Okay, so obviously you're very academic, and did you remain academic through college?
Yeah, college was fine. I got two A's and a B. I just missed an A on one of them.
And what is it you did? What subjects?
So history, English and sociology.
Okay.
And I must have done something. Oh, and first year I did art as well, but dropped art.
Okay. So and I suppose my question is, so you've come off the back of good GCSEs, you go into college. Was the plan always to go to university? And at what stage did you start thinking about potentially what you wanted to do after uni?
Yeah, I think part of, like, when I said, because it was a state school I went to, but it was a good state school, I think the aspirations were there from school times. Like, it was just like,
to do what?
The friends I had to go to uni.
Okay.
So you were asking, like, did you think you were always going to go to uni? I think that was quite like, from year seven, I feel like that was quite like the friends I made. That was just what everyone talked about and what everyone said they were going to do. Mm-hmm. So I think that was kind of just what I thought the next step was, if that makes sense.
So understood, but like with that in mind, so yes, that's the aspiration to go to uni, but when you went to uni, like, did you already have an idea in your head as to what you wanted to do post uni?
Yeah, I think so. From really young, I thought I wanted to be a primary school teacher.
Okay.
So I did lots of work with kids as a teenager. I worked in a play school. I did lots of babysitting. And yeah, I thought I wanted to be a primary school teacher.
Okay.
So I picked a degree, not a teaching degree, but I picked a degree that I thought that was like a curriculum subject, if that makes sense.
To those who might not know what a curriculum subject is, please elaborate.
Okay, so like English, maths, history, one of the kind of core subjects rather than one of the additional ones. So,
okay.
Because my thoughts was I do a normal degree, then I do a PGCE, which is like the teacher kind of additional degree to convert to teaching.
So we're jumping ahead, but if you knew you wanted to be a teacher, why, I don't want to say waste your time doing a degree first if you know you're going to do the PGCE, why not just go straight into teacher training?
Yeah, because I also thought I would want to keep my options open. Like, okay, what if I didn't like teaching, or what if 10 years later I wanted a career change? I'd also researched and you could get a bursary for teaching, so I could get a 10 grand bursary for teaching if I got a first in my degree. So I was quite like, I guess I have always been quite forward thinking.
Yeah.
So I looked ahead at like what costs would be, what bursaries I could get. Yeah, so I think it just made my options more open rather than limiting myself.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. So I think the first kind of takeaway there is, for anybody who potentially wants to go into a teaching role, maybe doing a separate degree at first might make sense, just in terms of keeping your options open if it's not something that you potentially see yourself doing long term. Is that a fair enough assumption?
Yeah, do you know, and I don't think that's teaching, I think that's all of the kind of public sector professions.
Okay.
There are a lot of graduate routes in now, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of entries that don't require your first 3-year degree to be that.
Okay.
So I think and then it does just leave you, you know, you're going to work for a long time.
Of course.
You graduate at 21, 22, you're going to be working for ages. So I think, yeah, having that other option just means that if you do want a career change later, you've got something to go on.
Okay, so bringing it back to sixth form, we know obviously that you did very well, but I suppose for the younger listeners out there, taking it back, do you remember the decision process for deciding on the university that you wanted to go to? Obviously you lived in Cambridge at the time, so maybe there was an appeal for London. For me, it was like getting the hell out of Dodge and moving away from London. How far out did you start thinking about that process, and what was that process like?
Yeah, so I took a year out in between college and then uni, and I knew that I wanted to do that. So I applied with like deferred entry, if that makes sense. So I applied for that in the first place, but I did do my application at the same time as everyone else.
Yeah.
So I had a couple of friends who also definitely went to go to uni. So we did visits together. Like, we went and visited quite a lot of different cities and universities.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, which again, like, I think because we were all working, we could pay for our trains, we could go and do that. And that was really nice. So I visited loads, actually, like Bristol, Leicester, Leeds, like London, where else? I can't remember. Those are the ones I remember.
Did you, when you were deciding on the unis to visit, were you like looking at the league table for the potential subjects that you wanted to do? Because like, how was there a guarantee that the subject you wanted to do was the same as the subject your friends wanted to do, and then you've ended up going to visit the same unis?
Yeah, so it was by course.
Okay.
And it happened that one of my best friends, who I've known since primary school, so we went primary school together, secondary school and college together, both of us were interested in the same subject, and it's quite a niche one, so social anthropology.
Okay.
Which basically was quite helpful.
Anthropology is culture, right, for those listening?
Yeah.
I always used to think it was feet. I don't know why. It just sounds like a medical subject.
It's definitely
but,
not feet.
I've cut you up there, go.
Yeah, it's definitely not feet. yeah, well, do you know what? I don't feel qualified to talk on it because I dropped out, but I keep giving you you know, 3 years in advance.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But yeah, basically I thought what I wanted to do was social anthropology. And that's like, it was helpful for choosing a uni because not many places do it. So it narrowed down my like pool, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think I would say when I was younger, I definitely wasn't always very confident in my abilities. I didn't always think I was going to do as well as I was going to do. Like every time I got results, it was like a surprise to me. So I kind of like parallel planned. So I had, I'd applied to universities that were like top of the league tables, required me to get A's or, you know, all A's or AAB. But I also applied to some that were slightly lower just in case. I think, you know, it's hard to know. Predicted grades are there for a reason, but like it's sometimes hard to feel confident because, you know, like if you mess up one exam, you mess up two exams. So I think I was always a bit of a parallel planner. So I had to kind of both options.
Okay, nice. And you mentioned the fact that you took a year out. This used to be a travel podcast, if I've not said that already. I always do. How come you decided to take a year out? Let's briefly touch on what you did in that year. And yeah, let's unpack that.
Yeah. I think my friend who I went like traveling, I went away for a lot of the year. And I think my friend who I went with was a really big influence there. Like I feel like credit to her. She was so much more organized than me in terms of knowing places to go. And she traveled more than me. So like when I was younger, we didn't really travel in my family much when I was a child. Like we went to my mum and my auntie would go to Scotland every year. And then with my dad, we'd usually go Devon because that was where I had family. So it was like, if we did trips, it was more like driving somewhere else in the UK kind of vibe. But my friend who I went away with, Amy, had traveled a lot more. Like her dad actually took, well, obviously her and her dad, but took me on a holiday. I'm going to forget where, Mallorca, when we were in college. So like, that was like, I hadn't been abroad lots as a child. And I think lots of my friends did travel more. Like, I just had families that could afford abroad holidays more. And it kind of, so then I think it appealed to me because I was around people that were doing it more. Nice. And yeah, she did have more like knowledge than me, I think, about places to go that'd be interesting. And so I think I was really lucky that she kind of let
me
do that.
So just touching on some of the places that you visited. Yeah, where did you go?
You're going back to travel podcast mode.
Have to.
Do you want me to just like list them all? Or?
Yeah, okay. A lot that come to mind.
Mauritius, South Africa, India, Japan, Thailand, Australia, Brazil, Peru, Mexico, then through America, like LA.
Not enough. You didn't do enough. No, I'm joking. That's amazing. That's amazing. And
yeah, ridiculous.
Yeah, just for any potential people, you know, looking to do a gap year, where was your favorite place to go and why?
Okay, so my favorite was Brazil. Like, I love Brazil and I've been back a couple of times afterwards. But one thing I will say is that my parents are very relaxed and lenient. If I had an 18-year-old child, they would not be doing all that. Like, I, honestly, okay. I think it's one of those things, I don't know if everyone else is like this, but I felt so grown up and now I'm like, I was a baby. Yeah. Like when I think about some of the decisions I made, I'm like, I didn't have a like fully functioning adult brain. Like that was a lot to do at an age where like, you know, you're just not.
But a lot of people do gap years at like 18 years old.
I know,
old.
I think it's bonkers.
So is it a case that what they do too much? Are you saying don't do it
no,
at all?
I like, don't know.
What is the advice, I suppose?
No, and also like, I guess, you know, like, me and Amy, my friend who went, like both of us had jobs, both of us worked, both of us saved, both of us paid for it ourselves. So like, I don't know, as a parent, what are you going to do? Be like, you're now 18 and you can't spend your own money doing what you want. I don't know. But I think so you know better.
You're going to be the parent that every child despises, went and had the experience, but isn't going to let their
yeah,
child do it.
Yeah, because I know all the mad stuff that can happen. So I'm like,
but if you survived,
yeah,
surely your child will be able to survive.
So my nephew, one of my nephews is now 17. And the idea that in a year he could go and do that is like mind blowing to me. It's like, absolutely not. Like,
okay.
I mean, some of it, but maybe like, I don't know, one, two places where you've got family, just a bit more.
But just to bring it back,
yeah,
to anybody looking to potentially travel,
it is amazing. Yeah, it is amazing.
Brazil, number one, it's amazing. Number two, Brazil is the place to go. And in terms of, I suppose, just one more takeaway before we move on from this, in terms of prepping for traveling for, you know, such a prolonged period of time, what's the best piece of advice you could give to the listeners? I know that your friend planned a lot of it.
I think going to places where you know someone really makes a difference. So if you know somebody who's from there, who lives there, like I think the experience you have will always be kind of more interesting and like with local knowledge. Do you know what I mean? Like it makes you feel like less of a tourist. You get to see things that are just like normal day to day. And I guess that's, but maybe that's just me. I like things that are normal day to day. Like I like seeing a place from that perspective.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Back to the original offering. Yeah. So with that, you're back a year later and it's time to go to university. So yeah, where is it that you end up going and what is it you end up doing?
Mm-hmm. So I moved to London for uni and went to SOAS, which, if people don't know, is the School of Oriental and African Studies. Horrible, outdated name that should be changed. It's quite a small university. It's part of the University of London, so it's like one of the kind of sites as part of the University of London. It's quite a small university. There's more like postgrad stuff than undergrad. And it's obviously, you're in London, it's not a campus. So it's like you just live in London.
And what is it you did there?
So in my first year, anthropology, joined with history. But I did drop
out. Sounds like a great course.
Yeah.
You really mentioned there that you dropped out. How come?
I think when I got to SOAS, I felt super intimidated. Like, it's actually, like, lots of people that go to that university have gone to private schools. There's lots of kind of international students who are from like very wealthy backgrounds, again, like privately educated. And I think I just got there and felt a bit out of my depth. So I just felt like, so like in the kind of tutorials, like the things people knew were just like, I don't know, they'd sit at home and talk about Foucault, who's like some theorist. I'd be like, I'd sit at home on the sofa and watch EastEnders. It just felt a bit, I don't know.
Imposter syndrome? Is that what it is?
People use that. People use that. So maybe it was that a bit.
The imposter syndrome was so bad that you like dropped out of the degree.
No. I didn't drop out of the degree. I just changed my course.
Okay.
So anthropology to me felt more like that.
Okay.
So when I looked at the cohort of people in that group compared to maybe the people that were in my history course, I think I just felt, or loads of my friends did anthropology. So it's not just that. It was also like the type of learning. It was really like social theory heavy, which is like very, like, I don't know, very old and very theory heavy. And I think I did just find it intimidating. And it was super interesting, but I think I felt, and I was also being tactical, I think I felt like I'd be more likely to get a first and get a better grade if I did straight history. So it wasn't I dropped out, it was just that I changed course, if that makes sense.
So did you do the whole first year?
Yeah, whole first year joint honours.
Okay.
And then I switched for my second and third year just to history.
Okay, and so you just switched to just history.
Yeah.
How did you do in your first year?
Yeah, well.
Okay, and do you think that...
I was probably worrying, like, this is what I said before, I think sometimes I would often imagine I was going to do worse and then I would do better.
So then I suppose with that, like, you did well. Does that not help with the imposter syndrome? And maybe, like, did you think at the time, or maybe I should keep both, or no, your mind was made up? I'm just trying to think for any people who are potentially going through this at the moment.
Yeah,
like what the decision making process is like in case they need to, you know, switch at the end of their first year or potentially think.
I don't regret changing course. I think like I was enjoying history more. I was confident I would get better grades in it. I don't think there's any disadvantage to me changing to a straight history course, if that makes sense.
And I suppose when you were changing course, and you know, you've mentioned the fact that you're doing better grades, this once again with the end goal in mind of, you know, I want to get a job, or I'm going to get that bursary.
Yeah, it was a bursary
with the best grade.
Yeah,
and that's why. So I suppose to anybody listening, if there is an incentive, you need to factor that into the decision as to whether you keep going with a course.
And it did factor into my decision making quite a bit, because you could do floater modules at our uni. So like you could choose to do one module not in your degree and do something like SOAS does loads of interesting languages. Like you could have done Swahili, I could have done Yoruba, I could have done, but again, I didn't, because I was too nervous that I might not get a good mark.
Yeah.
So I didn't, but it was very much, it was because there was a financial incentive for me. Like I would have been really happy to come out of uni with a 2-1 generally. I think that's an amazing degree, but because I knew that I would get this 10 grand bursary, I was like, I can't.
So then I suppose we're jumping ahead a bit, and I do want to bring it back. The university experience for you as a whole, it sounds like it was more pressure than like enjoyment, because it sounds like the bursary, you know, that's like a big North Star for you from beginning to end. So what was your general university experience like outside of just the academics, and you know, with regards to making friends, you know, your experience there, what was that like?
Yeah, I think I've probably made it sound like pressure, but actually I like learning, I enjoy studying, so it wasn't that much pressure, because I also wanted to do that and wanted to do well. And I think I was just quite aware that it's like, why would I get into debt just for enjoyment? Like, come on, this is also...
You'd be surprised how many people do that.
Okay, yeah, fine. I've heard about Southampton. But I think also because we didn't really talk about this, but when I was in like college age and stuff, I went out a lot. So I was like, my parents were quite relaxed. I didn't have a curfew. Like we spent a lot of time in my college years going like to clubs all the time. We were out a lot. So I think I kind of was also, by the time I was 18, I was a bit like... semi-bored of it. Like,
just for the listeners, this is the same woman who, when she has a child, is not going to let them travel.
Correct. Even correct. No, they can travel to a safe place where there's going to be a parent or carer or family friend.
So we digressed. So you went out a lot.
Yeah, so I went out a lot in college. And I think it just meant that by the time I got to 18, that wasn't my focus. It was like I kind of done that quite a lot. I'm not going to get into loads of debt to not even engage in the learning and not get something good out of it. And I guess that's an advantage of doing such an interesting course. Like the quality teaching at SOAS is amazing. Mm. And like then, so my modules ended up being all African history because that was the only intro course I did in my first year. Mm. And yeah, like the quality of what you learn is so interesting.
Shout out SOAS.
Yeah, yeah. It's an amazing place. But you're asking, I guess, the experience more generally. And it's not, we didn't go out. We did go out, but it just wasn't all the time. So I would say I went out more 16 to 18 than I went out in uni, basically.
Okay, and I suppose, how did you do at uni overall? Did you get that first and get that bursary?
Yeah.
Fantastic. So before I give you the plaudits, I suppose for anybody listening who is aspiring to achieve a first, it sounds like from a very early age, I suppose you were quite academic and you were quite forward thinking, like you said, and you kind of set yourself a goal and you achieved it. Through years two and three now, thinking about that, and even the first year, what processes did you put in place that allowed you to achieve such a great result?
One thing it's not even a regret, but I did, like, in first year I had like 100% attendance on my lectures. I got really good grades, and that doesn't count. So one thing I would say is if you want to relax a little bit, first year is the time to do it, because second and third year is when it counts. So I think I could have been easier on myself first year with like hindsight, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but
you get into good habits, and I think that's what happened. I got into quite good study habits, which helped me for second and third year, because then it's like you're maintaining something you've already built rather than trying to suddenly fix up when you've been having a mad year.
So having a sturdy base, don't build the house on sand, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it.
And then in terms of studying, it's been such a long time since I did that. No, I'm always learning this podcast. I'm always learning. Were you a crammer, or were you just I learned all the way through, and then by the time exams came around, I was just topping up the well of knowledge?
Yeah, I'm that boring second one, probably. I would go to the library a lot. So like I would either go to SOAS Library, I'd go to Wood Green Library, I'd go to the National Library. Like I think one of the nice things about when you go uni in London is like you've got so much resource around you, if that makes sense. Yeah. So you've got loads of places you can go. It's not a bubble, like you're living in a big capital city. So I think I would go to the library a lot. I'd study with friends a lot. I'd make study social.
Okay, that's great. Make study
what
social.
A geek. Ooh. What a geek.
Yeah. Hey, can I just say, geek is sexy in 2023. You know, hold tight, streamers, all them things, Twitch, YouTube, let's go. Okay, so with that, like we said, you get the first, you smash it out of the park. I suppose as you're coming to the end of the year, do you have a job lined up, or is it a case you've got to wait for your results, wait till you realise you've got the bursary before you can go and start looking for jobs? Like, what was that?
I just had to be like, what did I do? So I actually took another year out at that point, but I planned it.
Oh, okay.
So I had applied for my place for the PGC, the teaching degree.
Yeah.
I'd got that at Institute of Education, which is another London-based university. Mm-hmm. But what I wanted to do was go back to Brazil. So because I've been to Brazil before, and I mentioned that was my favorite place.
Yeah.
When we were there before, we'd done some like teaching with like children, so like I guess I'd kind of made roots there, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I went back to Brazil to do some more teaching. So I did a teaching qualification, like a short one, like I think it's called like a CELTA course. So like to teach
in Brazil?
No, I did that first here in the UK, and it's like a teaching qualification, so you can teach English to adults.
And how long, for anybody who potentially wants to teach English abroad, how long does the course take?
A month? I think it was a month. Okay. And it is like
it's free,
a proper
or paid for?
No, paid for. So it was an investment again, but it is like a proper qualification. I did it with a broken arm because I didn't necessarily enjoy the course hugely, but I did really enjoy the time in Brazil. I did enjoy teaching there.
And what is teaching English like in a country like Brazil for anybody who potentially wants to do something like that?
Well, I did it with kids. So, I guess it would depend on the setting, on how you're doing it. Like I did it, I paid to get a qualification to then do it voluntarily. So that was really smart of me. but I did it voluntarily with kids. So it was like in a favela, which is like one of their kind of lower socioeconomic areas. So it was like, yeah. So it was a project there that like a woman I'd met before ran. So she'd like been born there, brought up there, and she ran this project, but it was based on, she needed volunteers to come and do periods of teaching. So I can't remember how many months I was there for anymore, because it was
order to teach English, this is something I always wonder, obviously in Brazil they talk Portuguese, right?
Yeah.
So did that require you to have some understanding of Portuguese so you could
teach?
Yeah,
I would say some understanding helps. So like, I would not say I'm good, like don't ask me to speak it, but I can understand, like back then I could understand a fair bit and I could speak a little bit.
And how did that learning come about?
Just from being there. So I've been there twice. Wow. Both times I stayed for a few months at a time.
Oh, okay.
I think my friend, again, the one I went traveling with, maybe bought me a book. So like it was more bits and pieces and picking it up.
Yeah.
I didn't do any like formal study.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's great. So you've done uni. You've been away for a second time. I mean, I know people take gap year, but you took gap year times two. You're back in the UK. What is next for Catherine?
So teaching, I started my like PGCE, so my like conversion teaching degree.
Okay.
And quite quickly realised it wasn't the right job. I'd done some, because I didn't go away for a whole year. I also did teaching assistant work in the UK. Okay. So I'd done that to get more experience before my teaching. And I think when I was doing the TA work, I really loved it. Like often you're one-to-one, you're working with a child who's got more complex needs, or you're doing small group work with kids, again, who might be behind in their learning for any reason. They might be like English as an additional language, or they might have kind of some learning needs. So I think I'd done that work and really enjoyed it. Then started the teaching like qualification, and like started my first placement and was like, this isn't for me. It's just not.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
So just to kind of summarize the story, we've spent 3 years at university. We've done some teaching abroad. It probably takes us to about 4 years, give or take. And then within how many weeks or months did we decide it's not for us and then leave?
Yeah. So I dropped out within the first term, and the reason for that was about cost. So like if I'd stayed a next term, I would have had another next term's worth of tuition, like loan tuition fees to pay back. Mm-hmm. And because, so I got the 10 grand bursary, but because I didn't complete it, I had to give it back.
All of it?
Yeah, you don't get to keep
mad.
It. Which is fair. No,
but you still had to pay, the first month's...
The first term of tuition fees. But that's why I made the decision to drop out at the end of that term.
Yeah.
Because I think I was quite concrete that I was like, I could do this. I could get through this. I could be a teacher, but it's not... Like, you know, when you're like in your heart, I was like, it's not for me. Like... I could get through it, but it would be a struggle. Like I wouldn't be enjoying it and I wouldn't be feeling passionate about it. It would be like...
Okay. And sorry, just to ask you like a bit of a personal question. Mm. Obviously, you know, we've spoken about the bursary and I know like a lot of people, you know, they work towards that bursary. Was there, I suppose, like a personal driver for that bursary? Were you putting it towards like a deposit on a house? Was it just
the bursary was to cover your tuition fees and stuff.
Oh, that's
so
what it was.
It just meant that you weren't like getting into more debt. Okay, so that was my personal drive, not getting into more debt, basically.
Okay, cool. So it was just to get that education for free.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Oh, so basically, if you don't get a first, you have to pay for additional PGCE. Oh my goodness!
But fair enough.
Like, and then they pay you peanuts after. Goodness gracious!
Yeah, but that's why you need to love it. That's why you need to feel like
we're going to get a teacher on this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to get one.
Yeah, you've got some good ones. I think teaching is an amazing job. Like, I think people that do it, it's literally such an amazing job. It's so important. But I think there was a few reasons why I realised it wasn't for me, and I think one of them. I didn't love standing up in front of 30 children. Like I love working with people, but I like it to be more like building relationships, building more like close relationships, having more like in-depth conversations, and standing up in front of 30 kids and making them learn stuff that frankly, some of it's crap. Like when you look at the curriculum, I just didn't agree with a lot of it as well. I think SOAS is like, if anyone doesn't know, a super left-wing university. It's like very, very, very left-wing, very alternative. It completely changed my perception of the world, if that makes sense. So like history, like the first thing we did was learn how Eurocentric our education had been so far. So it was literally basically like the first bit of my degree was unlearning all the stuff I learned in school. It was like you've had a whitewashed version of world history and it's a mess. A mess. Yeah. And I think then, so to have gone to SOAS, then started in primary school and then be like, I'm having to teach these kids complete nonsense. Mm. And especially I was in a London school, I think it was in Tottenham. It's like most of the kids in that class are not white. Like they're like, heritage is not British, and then we're going to tell them about what is it you always do, the Tudors. Like I just and Richard I think
DeLion,
yeah, and history wasn't the worst subject. I mean, I just think, And when you see the kids that struggle, as a TA, I got to work with them and I got to take them out and support them and help their learning. But as a teacher, it felt like any kid that was having a difficult time just had to get out of the classroom.
Yeah.
So I didn't get to interact with them. I didn't get to support them. And I think, yeah, that didn't sit right with me either. It was like any child coming from in a more tricky situation, you see the vulnerability and you don't engage with it as a teacher. And that, yeah, so that was part of the reason as well.
Okay, so continuing on, you've decided to pull out of university. Obviously, you said that you knew in your mind that you wanted to do that. Had you already been thinking about what you wanted to do? Yes. Next, sorry. And what was the process of deciding on where you moved?
Do you know what? It was probably the first time. Sorry. The first time from when I was about like 10 that I didn't have a clear plan. Mm. So I think I decided in primary school that I was going to be a primary school teacher, and then I just stuck to it.
Who the hell? Primary school?
Yeah.
All I was thinking about in primary school was Trish Stratus and Stacey Keibler and from WWF. Bloody hell. You're all thinking about becoming a teacher.
I know, maybe it's weird. But anyway, I think I'd always thought I was going to do it. So it was like, it was quite fixed. So it was a bit scary because it was the first time for me that I didn't have like a clear, tangible plan, if that makes sense. But I also think it's like one of the best decisions I ever made. I'm so glad I dropped out. I'm so glad I didn't just finish it because I'd said it was what I was going to do or because other people thought I was going to be good at it. I knew it wasn't right for me. So I did drop out without a plan. So I got a job for an education charity and started working in that, which I knew when I got it. I was amazed that they even wanted me because I remember it's so mad now, but the pay was 22 grand. And I remember when I was doing the application, I was like, they're never going to hire me. Mm. This is a crazy salary. Why would they want me? And then they did. And I was like, oh, maybe I need to be like aiming higher sometimes, if that makes sense. Because I just thought like, that's too much. I wouldn't get paid that.
Mm.
But that for me was like a holding job.
It was more than me in my first job. So
yeah, it was like a PA and admin role for an education charity.
Mm.
But yeah, it was to buy time. It wasn't for a long-term thing, if that makes sense. It was like to pay rent, pay bills while I worked out the next step.
And then in terms of working out that next step, what was the process like for you and how long did it take?
Yeah, so I think it was a combination of things. The education charity that I was at had actually incubated this social work graduate scheme, basically. So like in the office of the education charity, I had heard lots about this scheme. I heard lots about like this children's social work scheme now that was like a new graduate scheme. So it meant you'd get paid to train and go into like children's social work.
Mm.
So I was hearing lots about it. When I dropped out of the teaching course, I'd also met with like the course leader who'd been like, basically said to me like, you know, we'll fully support you to drop out, but what do you think you want to do? And she talked to me and we had quite a nice conversation. And she said to me, she thought I'd either be a really good counsellor or maybe a really good social worker. So she'd kind of pointed me in that direction. Mm-hmm. I then like learned about this graduate scheme through where I was working. And I think the other thing that I was saying, part of the reason I dropped out of teaching, because I was noticing that some of the kids that were maybe having a more tricky time were not being supported in an education, like in a mainstream education setting very well. I think I was drawn to the kids that are having a more tricky time and that aren't necessarily, you know, there's the stuff going on for them outside of school that might be causing them not to be able to learn as well as they could.
I mean, I'm just trying to soak everything in. This is great, can I just say? So I suppose with everything that you said with regards to wanting to be a teacher, you know, working for the charity, potentially being a counsellor or social worker, it sounds like you've always been pretty set in working in the public sector. Am I right in saying that? Because a lot of people who we've had on the podcast, they don't typically go into the public sector. So this is very refreshing. So have you always been unwavering in the sense that you wanted to work with kids or in the public sector or both?
So I always wanted to work with children. So I think that's always been that's been completely consistent for me. And I guess if you want to do that, it's going to be the public or the voluntary sector.
And what is it about children and vulnerable children and wanting to help them, I suppose that draws you to the role and any potential people that might want to get into what you do?
I think so. I've talked you through like what like education and professional reasons for getting in. I think also I had some personal reasons for social work appealing.
Yeah.
So I've got two sisters. One of them, when we were teenagers, was like had a disability. So she has something called ME, which is like a chronic fatigue syndrome type thing. Mm-hmm. So she didn't go to kind of mainstream secondary school. She was in a wheelchair for some of our childhoods and couldn't access education like that. So through her experiences, we had some involvement with like professionals. As a child, I can't tell you. I don't know if they were social workers. I don't know if they were OTs. I don't know who they were or what they were. But I guess I saw that difference, and I saw that like more different experience, difficult experience. If professionals hadn't been helpful, she wouldn't have achieved. She wouldn't have done as well as she did. So I think I'd seen that. And then my other sister had my nephew quite young. So she had him when we were both teenagers. Mm. And I think often, you know, if you have a child as a teenager, if you have a child quite young, that comes with some complications, things can be tricky. So I think I'd been around some of those issues and some of the things she went through that were hard. And I'd seen kind of maybe where she sometimes got support, maybe where she could have had more support or support could have been better. Mm. So I think like where I think everyone or yeah, I think everyone, most people will know what a teacher is, what a teacher does, because they'll have gone to school or they'll have had an education. Mm. I think lots of people don't even really know social work exists. They don't know what it is. They don't know what it does. Mm-hmm. Whereas I guess I did know what it was. I knew what the point of it was. I understood, you know, roughly what it did. I think I probably had some misconceptions about it, like probably negative misconceptions, because I think I'd known people who'd had social workers. And often the feelings weren't positive about that. It was like, we want to get rid of them, leave me alone, go away, kind of, you know, why are they meddling, that kind of vibe. Mm. But I think, I guess as I got older, I saw more what the potential for it to be a really good thing and the potential for it to be something that changes things positively for people, for children, for families. So yeah, it was like the combination.
And, you know, that leads us nicely into it. Mm-hmm. I suppose you've kind of touched upon it there, but for those who might have a common misconception about social work or not understand what it is, how would you define social work and being a social worker?
Yeah, so when you qualify as a social worker in the UK, you actually qualify to do children and adult social work.
Okay.
Which is interesting to me because I would not feel qualified to do adult social work. I've only ever done children's placements. I've only ever had children's jobs. But so I can't really speak to adults, but I can speak to children's. Mm-hmm. I've always worked within like child in need, child protection social work. Mm-hmm. So that's like statutory social work. Every council, every local authority in the country has a duty to provide it. Mm-hmm. And that's about providing support to families in situations where there's risk. And that can either be kind of, I suppose, risk that children won't achieve. So like risk they won't kind of maintain good levels of health, good levels of education. And without support, they won't meet their potential. Or it can be at a more serious level where you think there's risk of harm, like risk of significant harm to those children. And then it's, a higher level of intervention, which is more about kind of, that, you know, supporting families to make changes that need to happen for safety.
Sorry, I've just got to ask. So when you say, you know, you help kids who you don't feel are going to achieve their potential, mm-hmm. can we just unpack that? Like, what does that mean? That is complete news to me.
Yeah, so so that would be like, child in need is the name of like the type of plan that you would support that family on.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a good example. So like children who have disabilities are entitled to support under the child in need part of like legally they're entitled to child in need support.
Okay.
So it might be a child who is otherwise not going to achieve to the best of their potential. Okay. Maybe they, you know, like my sister don't have access to education because of a disability and it's like a barrier to them accessing it.
So then I suppose a question that's come into my mind, and like don't shoot me for this, but I think it would be good to understand the difference from that standpoint between a social worker and like a TA. Like, are you working side by side with a TA to help people with potential social, because I'm assuming TAs work with people with social disabilities, or have I got that?
So often kids we work with, if they have like an educational need, might have a TA in school.
And TA stands for teaching assistant.
Yeah, sorry,
just for listening.
But social workers don't work in school. Well, you can be a school-based social worker, but we work for the council and we work with families in all environments. So like we go do home visits. We also then, like a big part of our job is multidisciplinary. So it's about working with everyone important to that child. So that will be their school. That will be their GP surgery. That might be a midwife if it's, you know, a pregnant woman, or it will be like a health visitor for children 0 to 5. It might be youth offending services if it's a teenager who's been criminalized. So it's like we work in a really broad way with all other professionals and family members who are involved with that family.
Do you know what's so crazy about what you've just said? So I obviously work in customer success.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like you're a customer success manager, but for a
bio, I've told you this before. I said that our jobs are really similar. You just get paid silly money and I don't get paid anything, and mine's more stressful. In summary, you know, people should become social workers.
Okay, and just taking it back a little bit, so you mentioned that you went on a social worker grad scheme. Mm-hmm. So does everybody have to go on a grad scheme in order to become a social worker?
No, so it's much like teaching. I say all the public sector professions are like this. You can do an undergraduate degree to get into it, you can do a master's to get into it, or most of them now have like a graduate scheme that you can use to get into it.
And how long did your graduate scheme go on for, just out of interest?
So it was 2 years. First year you get your like social work qualification, so you are on placements and then you're qualified at the end of the first year. Second year I got to do a master's that was free alongside work, so they're a really good option if you're a career changer, if that makes sense. So I think like where I was older, like I'd obviously taken time out, I'd worked, it was a good option for me because it didn't mean taking out another loan, it didn't mean like going back to university in a traditional sense, it allowed me to stay working the whole time. So you're on placement, you're working from like, basically there was like a 5 week summer institute where you were just doing intensive learning.
Yeah.
Then you get placed in your local authority, so that's when I went to East London.
Okay.
And you're then there for 2 years, so it's like,
okay, so many questions. So the master's that you did, do you have to do a master's, or like why did you do that?
I mean, who wouldn't want to do a free master's?
Okay, just to say you had the
Yeah,
the
yeah. I mean, it's
and
another...
And what did you master in, sorry?
So research policy and practice was what mine was in, but okay. Some people's were in systemic family therapy. So there was two options at the time I did my course, but I think now they've only got one option. Mm-hmm. But I mean, for me, it was just like, again, it's such a lucky opportunity. You're getting a free master's. So like it was 2 years of a lot of hard work. So
yeah.
Like you're learning a whole new profession alongside really heavy academic work.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say like, yeah, it's not like an easy option, but it's a good option if you want to career change without taking the kind of hit of more loans and yeah, time out of work, if that makes sense. So the first year my grant was like the equivalent of a 21k salary, so like it wasn't a massive drop for me.
Yeah.
And then second year you qualify and you're then on like a starting social work salary, so I think it was something like 30, so it was a good jump for your second year.
Okay, great. And then on that, oh my days, my mind's going blank. Oh my god, it's gonna see this is what happens when you don't prepare and you do everything off the cuff. So you've done your master's, and typically, you know, we hear a lot of people come on a podcast and say you know, what we study at uni, it's not applicable to what we do in our job.
Mm.
But those two intensive years, do they prepare you for social work? Are they like, yes, they're intense, but are they relevant to what,
yeah,
to what you do?
It's not 2 years of study, it's on the job. Do you
okay.
know what I mean?
But okay,
also,
so, okay.
I would also say that what I did in my undergraduate degree was really relevant. Like, you know what I was saying?
So just understanding culture and stuff like that?
Yeah, understanding culture. Also realising like how Eurocentric things are in the UK, like understanding those things, because in social work, you're working with families who are often facing like multiple disadvantages. Like they're often families that are being treated terribly by various levels of system. And I think if you don't understand like oppression, you don't understand racism, you don't understand those kind of things, which I think SOAS really taught me, then you can't be a social worker. You shouldn't be a social worker. Like, because we're working.
But not everybody goes to SOAS, right?
No, of course not. But I just mean, I think those are issues that you do have to really care about and actively commit to learning. Like obviously we're always learning, like obviously we're also unlearning. Like I think, like I said to you at SOAS, I feel like I did a lot of unlearning and stuff that I've been taught that wasn't good.
Sorry to jump in there, because I think it's great that you did that, but you know, thinking to the people that you work with in East London and the people that you work with now, like would you say that you all sing from the same hymn sheet? And what I mean by that is that you've all done a similar kind of unlearning and, you know, think quite similarly about society and culture.
I think so, like social work as a profession is underpinned by social justice values, right?
Yeah.
So it's about social justice. And I think anti-oppressive practice is like, that is the expectation. And I'm not here pretending I don't get it wrong. I'm sure there's times that I've not understood a family's experience, or I've not advocated for them right, or I haven't seen, you know, I can't understand. You can't understand everything about someone's experience.
Mm.
But I think those are the kind of the foundations of the profession, the cornerstones of the profession. Do I think it's perfect? Absolutely not. Like, you know, you talk about, you know, racism in education. Like, I think like Black Caribbean children 3 to 4 times more likely to be permanently excluded from school.
Mad.
Like lots of people know stats around stop and search, like again, Black Caribbean boys particularly likely to be stopped and searched by police, but social care is not like innocent either, if that makes sense. Like, we again disproportionately, Black Caribbean children are overrepresented in the care statistics, so children who become looked after, and I think Black and white children, so mixed race, white British Caribbean heritage children, also overrepresented. So
as in like they're just being flung social workers even though they don't need them?
I don't think it's as simple as that, because if you think about...
Or it's being flagged because of like some predetermined biases in...
Yeah, there'll be biases, but I think it's also, it's not... I don't know the statistics on actually like referral rates, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I know that in terms of children who become looked after, who come into care, they're really overrepresented at that point. Mm-hmm. So that is when we have made, like social workers, social care has made decisions about whether they're safe at home or not safe at home. So I think, you know, we need to look internally as a profession as well what we're doing, you know, and things, you know, things like in all sectors, but like look at your senior leaders, how diverse is that, like how representative is that, like if you're in a borough and you're working with families, like if you know the percentage of families in your borough that are white British is whatever, like you want to think about the representation at all levels, if that makes sense.
Is your current borough well represented and diverse?
I would say at a social worker level better, and then the more senior you go, like the worse it gets, which I think is true across the board, right? So you'll have less women as you go up, you'll have less people who aren't white as you go up. So I think you know,
basically we got white men at the top. That's how I heard that.
Yeah, currently we do, but you know, I would say social work though is like female dominated, so I would say it's not like gender wise, I would say the representation is not as bad, but I think yeah, and increasingly like in the time I've been there actually we do have more managers and senior managers who are like Black or from minority ethnic backgrounds, and that's great to see. But yeah, it's just to say we have work to do too. It's not like I'm not being like police education.
No,
social work,
I understand
perfect.
That.
It's not.
This has been so good. There's so many directions we can take this in. I think what we'll do is we'll go back to East London, mm-hmm. because that's where you trained. For those people getting into social work, what were those first couple of years, I suppose, on site? Learning on the job, what were they like, and what advice do you have for anybody who potentially wants to get into social work and is going on site for the first time?
Yeah. I mean, first off, I love social work. A bio knows this about me. I love social work. So I think I really enjoy it. I've chosen to stay in practice for quite a long time compared to like average probably.
What is the average of people typically stay? And what is practice?
Oh yeah, sorry. So when I say practice, I mean a frontline social work job. So being a social worker who has allocated families and visits them and supports them, rather than like managing social workers or doing a job where you're like, you might go into a specialist team and give advice rather than actually having a caseload.
Okay, so, and yeah, sorry, the question there was how long do people typically stay on the frontline before going into...
I remember a stat saying 5 years and I don't know if it's true anymore.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, I mean, I think, I guess my first experiences in my student year and my newly qualified year, I just think it's such an interesting job. Every day is different. Your work is so varied. Like, you are not sat at a desk, you know what I mean? You're out and about all the time. You're seeing families in their homes. You're going in to see them in schools. You're supporting them with things like housing moves if they're not safe where they're living. Yeah. So it's like, it's very varied. And I think also like, when you're working with families and going into their private space, it's such a privilege.
Yeah.
I think like the fact that people even choose to open their door, let you in, like I know sometimes it's less of a choice, mm-hmm. but like I think it's huge and I think you should see it as a privilege. Like people are talking to you about intimate life experiences.
But sometimes they're forced to, right? It's not like their choice.
Yeah, I mean, but there's only so much you can ever force people, isn't
there?
Yeah,
that's true.
But I think, I guess what you can say in social work is, so like all... like child and need work is voluntary. Families are choosing to engage with that. Mm-hmm. And if they say, I don't want the support anymore, the plan will end. That's it, gone. So when it gets to child protection, yes, it's more of a statutory requirement because those children are at risk of significant harm. Mm-hmm. So if families don't want to engage with us, we would continue trying to engage with them. Mm-hmm. So like we would go around, even if they said that they don't want us to work with them, we would continue to try and build a relationship. But I think like it's relationship-based practice. Like at the heart of this, what you're doing, you're not trying to oppress people, you're trying to build relationships with people, to support them, to have lives that are safer, that are happier and that are more positive.
Sounds very rewarding.
And yeah, it's really, really rewarding. And I think, but like as much as it's rewarding, I think sometimes, I think some people going in, imagine you're going to see these like massive changes. Like, you know, you're going to meet this family, you're going to, and it's like, I think you have to be someone that's like happy with and like takes joy out of small wins sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like you're not necessarily going to see things turn around totally for a family. Like life is much more complicated than that. You have to be happy to see small bits of progress and recognize the significance of it, I think. And I think, I guess what I would say as well is, it's like, obviously it's a job that can be quite vicariously traumatizing. Like, you're working with families at really difficult points in their life. You're working with them when, you know, really unsafe, scary things are happening. So like, whether that's working with families when there's domestic abuse and violence, or like substance misuse difficulties, you know, you're coming in at a tricky time and you're asking them to talk to you and be open with you about things that are really hard. Mm. And I think that does take an emotional toll. So as much as it's hugely rewarding, it can also be really draining. And you've got to think, like, the position that, like, parents are in, like, you know, like you just said, I can't remember how you phrased it, but whatever, you know, people sometimes see us as a threat, and I can understand that. It's a really reasonable way to see us. But so that can mean sometimes, as much as...
I didn't
as,
say that. I just said, how did you sometimes, phrase it? Like, you're forced. Like,
people are forced to work with you.
You're not necessarily... Yeah. It's not necessarily
so, like,
choice.
I would love it if everyone just saw social workers as people there to help and make things better. Understood. Obviously, that's not how everyone sees it. Like, and I think that, you know, when people feel scared, when people feel defensive, when people feel worried that you're going to, you know, do something that they don't want, then... sometimes that brings out like more resistance, or it might be more tricky to work with someone who feels like that. So you can get, you know, aggression, you can get people getting frustrated and upset, and that is hard.
So on that, on the aggression, people being difficult, I suppose, you know, something I've always thought about, like, I don't know how to phrase this, like, and I hope it comes across well, but like, have you always felt safe in the job, or like, have you, or sometimes you allocated a case where, like you said, there's been domestic abuse and you're like, oh my god, like, this man might spark me out, or like, oh my god, that woman might draw for my hair, like, and give me a little yank, like,
I shouldn't,
or that
laugh.
Just doesn't, like, sorry, I shouldn't be making like a joke about
no.
But like, do those things enter your head, or are you so focused on making you know, those, getting those small wins, that it just doesn't even enter the cranium?
They should enter your head. As a social worker, they should enter your head, because the reality is, you're working with people in really difficult situations, and you're working with people who, some people who have vulnerabilities, like, you might be working with parents who've got like mental health needs, you might be working with parents who, you know, have not had safe experiences themselves. They might have been, you know, their own childhoods might not have been the easiest. Things might be normalized that aren't normalized for some other people. So like, the reality is, like, all those scenarios you just described, I know that all those things have happened to people that I work with, you know. So like, yes, I've worked with some dads who might use abuse and violence against their partner, who might also, the way they speak to me isn't great, you know, they might shout, they might swear, they might get angry, and it's not always pleasant. I think as a social worker, I actually think I did feel safe most of the time. I don't know if I should have, but I did, and I think that was because of the relationships I had generally. I would say actually it's been one of my big transitions becoming a manager. I feel so much more worried for my work, my social workers that I manage safety, than I did for my own.
Yeah.
So when I was out doing it, like,
a bit like you and your potential children, it seems like there's a theme here, people.
You're not wrong. And there's something about when you're the one doing it, you have the relationships, you know what I mean, like, you're risk assessing as you go, and maybe it is that my sense of safety for myself is higher. But then like, now managing
people, lower your sense of safety for yourself.
Well, I feel safer.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, definitely, like, now that I'm managing people, like, I'm always like, you know, we have things in place. We have to, as a profession, it's responsible. We have to have things in place. So like, I would expect the people that I work with to check out at the end of the day. So like, if you've got a late visit, message me afterwards, let me know it's done. Okay. Like, we would always have in our calendars, we would have the visits we're going on, where they are, because if someone did, you know, not turn up for the next thing, did go missing, you know, we would need to follow that up and make sure somebody is safe, because these things do happen. Like,
social workers go missing.
Not missing, but people do, you know, people do sometimes, Jesus. You know, it's not always safe.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
So I think, like, there was quite a prominent, I'm trying to remember where it was. There was quite a prominent case recently. I actually think it might have been in Canada, but I don't want to be wrong.
Where
a social worker got killed, you know.
And does this have an impact on your mental? Or just no, like, it's a bit like being a soldier. It just comes with a job. Like, honestly,
but it's not the same level of risk.
I'm just trying to
give
context to what might be going through your head.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, we do other things to mitigate the risk. You know, like, if it's a particularly risky situation, you might have another worker come with you, so you might work in a pair. So you know, we consider this and we do things, to try and manage that risk.
There's so much we can go into here. I am aware of the time, probably got about 10 minutes left. So just going back to East London, how long did you stay in East London for?
Oh God, you know, I'm so bad at days. 2014 to like 2018, 18, like December 2017, 2018, I think.
And what are the job titles? So, you know, you've mentioned that you're a manager now. What was kind of the progression path?
I was a student social worker there. Then I was an ASYE, which is like the silly acronym we have for a newly qualified worker.
Okay.
And then I was just a normal social worker there.
Okay. And then you moved to North London, is it?
Yeah.
And when you moved to North London, do you begin as a normal social worker?
Yeah, so I started in the, like, it was a sideways move for me. And it was a sideways move based on a couple of things. One was that in East London, like, it was a much tougher borough to work in. So, like, my caseload when I left there, I think, so bearing in mind I'm still quite newly qualified, but I think I had 27 children on my caseload. I had four different families that I was in court proceedings with. Mm. Since I've come to my North London borough, I've barely ever been over 20 children. I've never had more than one court case at a time. So, like, what I will say with social work is the working conditions are not the same in different boroughs. Like, if you're working somewhere and you're struggling, try somewhere else. Like, it's not all the same. And it is like I really miss the East London borough I worked in. And I feel like I felt a lot of loyalty and I felt so guilty leaving because I feel like the kids there, like, are getting a rough deal. Like, there's so little money. There's so little services. Like, I suppose I've come into social work at a time of austerity. I've only ever worked under austerity. So, like, all I've ever known is central government telling local government, make cuts, don't spend as much, rein it in. Like, you know, you need to find X amount of savings. And it's really hard. Working in the public sector under these conditions is really hard. And I felt that more in East London than I do in the North London borough I now work in. Like, there's much more support here. So, but yeah, I moved over in the same role. So it was a sideways move for me as a social worker. And then I moved into a senior social work role.
And how does that differ? So normal social worker, senior social worker.
Yeah, I think it's, I guess it's a recognition of experience. So it's like when you have got quite good experience, when you are like, yeah, I suppose, you know the job better, and it gives you a few different things. Part of it for me was that you get more complex casework. So I would have much less of the child in need type work, the kind of just helping, and I would have more of the complex cases, like longer term issues that are maybe more tricky and where the families might be more difficult to engage. So, like, building that relationship might be a bit harder. But I think I really enjoyed that. I like long term work. Mm. Like, I've had families that I've worked with for like 2-3 years. Like, I had one who, like, I think I worked with them for nearly 3 years, which is a very long time. Mm. But I closed them over 2 years ago and they text me at Christmas, you know, like, yeah. I think on my work phone. But I think, you know, like, those long term relationships mean a lot to me, and you tend to have those with the families where the issues are more complex.
So with the more complex cases, I'm just thinking back to the similarities, you know, more complex accounts, does that mean you have less accounts than some of the newer workers? They might get the in need, but they might have like up to 30 or something.
Not in the North London borough I work in, no. So they're like, the caseloads are just really reasonable. So they are just really reasonable. Like, they would never have 30 children, just doesn't happen. I was still on way lower, so I would be on lower because it was more complex.
And talking about reasonable, I suppose, what comes to mind is just the hours. Like, you know, you think about teachers, public sector, you know, teachers are worked to the bone. They got to do a lot of lesson planning. From your experience as a social worker, and for anybody, you know, potentially wanting to mentally prepare themselves, what are the hours like? And I know you enjoy the job, but, you know, are the demands like high? I suppose is the question.
So that was another reason. So, like, I guess your workload relates to your work-life balance, right? So like, when I was working in East London borough, my work-life balance was pretty bad, to be honest. Like, I would work late every night. Our hours are Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. But often, you know, you're visiting kids at home. They only get home from school at 4 p.m. You need to see 3 families in a day. You know, you can do the maths. You're not finishing at 5. So I think when I was working there, I was working late probably most nights, I would say. In my job now, I would say I work late on occasion, but it's when something significant happens and it's when it requires that response, and I don't mind doing it, like, because I know it's serious, I know it's significant, and I don't, you know, don't resent it. Like, is it annoying when you have to cancel a dinner plan? Of course it is, but whatever, you know, like, there's something more important happening, and it's occasional, I would say now. Like, generally, I would say since I've been in this borough, my work-life balance is good. I generally do work my hours. I work very hard in my hours. I will say that. It's not, you're not chilling out. You're not like, it is, you know, it's an intense job, but it's interesting. It's exciting. It's rewarding. So yeah, I think you can find a good work-life balance in social work. It's not impossible.
I'm glad to hear that. And then...
you might disagree. I don't know. Friends, family might disagree.
And then just in terms of progression, because, you know, there might be aspirational social workers. You know, you've mentioned that people might want to go into the specialist roles. I suppose the question I have is, like, how many levels are there to the game? So obviously, like, you're a manager, you know, you've mentioned that some people can go from social worker and then after 5 years they go into specialist. Is specialist the ceiling? Is it head of the specialist division? Is it specialist director? I suppose just to kind of give
I've explained that badly because it's none of that.
Okay.
When I say specialist, I mean more like if you have a particular interest in a certain area, like if you're really interested in domestic violence or you're really interested in
is it a sideways step rather than a promotion then?
Can be either.
Okay.
But like, yeah, you might want to move into a team that works just with teenagers who have been criminally exploited, or you might want to work in a team that just supports women who are victims of domestic violence.
Yeah.
So like, it's kind of like you would work alongside statutory services, but what you'd be providing would be specialist support. So okay, that's one option, like career wise if you want to stay in statutory. It's so like senior social worker is like the top job you can be in, where you're still working with families,
individual
and contributor as an individual contributor. Yeah, I've just been looking this stuff up because so that's like the top job you can do there. And I think part of what I really loved about senior role was you got your families, you're still working directly with children and families, which I love, but you also started to do more practice development. So like, I would co-work with new social workers. I had students, so I'd be practice educator and I would support students through placement, help them to understand what the job is and teach them. And like generally in the team, like you would take on a teaching role. So like we would have group supervision, group sessions where like I might facilitate things to help with learning. So in the senior role, there's more scope for that too, like practice development, which I think I really enjoyed it.
Okay. And then just as we wrap up, so obviously now you're a manager.
Mm.
How are you finding that? I know, obviously, speaking to you personally, you really like being on the front line. So how has that transition been for anybody who potentially wants to go into social work management? What does that involve for them?
Yeah, so the role I'm doing is like I manage five social workers, one student. So you provide case supervision to those workers. So you talk through with them, kind of you provide a reflective space for them to talk through about the families they're working with, what's working well, what feels stuck, kind of what experiences those families are having, like what we can do to support them better. You provide group learning spaces. It's very different because you're not doing the direct work, and I miss it. Like, you know, I love direct work with children and families and I do miss that, but I wanted to get this experience. So at the moment I'm like a secondment, so I'm trying it out for a year. And I think it's one thing I would say in social work, I think it's a very different skill set. So I think you could be an amazing social worker and not be a very good manager, or you could be a brilliant manager and not be a great social worker. So I think there's a lack sometimes of preparation for movement between those things. Sometimes it just feels a bit like you've done social work for a while, so you become a manager. And I think it's something people should really think about. Where does your skill set lie? What's your strength? And what do you care about? What motivates you?
I'm just thinking of how I'm going to wrap it up, and I suppose just some final thoughts for anybody wanting to get into social work or get into the public sector. I suppose what would be your advice for them?
I think it is that thing about what motivates you, what are you passionate about, what do you care about? And then what is your skill set? Because there's a lot of different roles in the public sector, you know, nursing, teaching, social work, you can work in prisons. I would try and unpick the options and understand what day to day, what does that job look like? What does it mean? So you can go in making an informed decision, because it is, you know, it's a commitment. You hold power and that is a privilege. Like you're working with people, they're real people, it's their real lives. So you've got to care.
In terms of, you know, you've mentioned unlearning, you mentioned some statistics around, Afro-Caribbean people being more likely to be over-indexed. Sorry, I've made that up.
Yeah, like overrepresented.
Overrepresented. Yeah. I suppose the final question there is, if people want to learn more about, you know, societal statistics and, you know, more information, where can they potentially find that? If you know off the top of your head,
that's a very good question.
I'm surprised.
If it's like you actually want to know more about social work, community care is a good like website. They probably have all the other things like Twitter, Instagram, but they write about social work news quite specifically. Otherwise,
we'll link it in the show notes.
Yeah, though. I just probably follow loads of really left-wing Instagram accounts and and Twitter. Like,
I don't know if I'm gonna link.
I can give bio some links, but I can't name them off the top of my head. There is a really a social worker. She was a social worker who now does podcasts and has a really good Instagram page. La la la. Let me explain. I really like her. She's. Yeah.
La la la, let me explain. You got a plug on my podcast. You're welcome. You're welcome.
She probably doesn't need it, but I mean, yeah, she's doing great work.
Okay. With that, Catherine, thank you. Thank you so much for this conversation. I feel like I've really been enlightened around social work, the concepts, and yeah, maybe some things that I necessarily didn't know before. Hopefully our listeners have as well. Thank you. Thank you so much. Typically, I would use this chance to say, yeah, are there any socials you wanna plug? Any good causes potentially?
When you're a social
plug?
Worker, all your socials are private.
There we go.
no plugging. Thanks.
I knew that. Yeah, just thank you so much for the time today. It's been a pleasure. If you've liked this episode, guys, please let us know in the comments. We might have to come back and do a part two so we can dive into some of the things we've discussed today in more detail. And with that, we have got to the end of the episode, guys. Please make sure you, if you've got to this stage, like, subscribe, comment on how you found the episode, share it. With that, guys, it's been Vibes and Tribes. Over and out.
Thanks.